At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello! Out there. I don't look up to serial killers. I don't want to think that anything about them is interesting or cool, but if I'm being honest, they get me sometimes. When Ramirez defiantly struts into the courtroom and shoots daggers at the cameras, I can't help it. I get goosebumps. The same from when I see footage of the library window from where Bundy jumped. For a moment, I'm like, run, Ted. Fucking go. Kill them all. Run, you crazy bastard. Run for the hills. Murder every woman on earth. I don't know what's wrong with me. They just get me sometimes. I forget that Ramirez raped, tortured, and killed old ladies, that Bundy returned to the dump sites of his victims and had sex with their bodies until he could not stand the smell any longer. Wasn't Ed Kemper interesting? Dahmer had such a boyish demeanor, didn't he? Carl Panzerheim was fucking awesome. Did you hear what he said before they executed him? That he could kill 10 men in the time it was taking them to kill one? Yeah, I heard all that. But I also heard that he sodomized a little boy, then bashed him to death with a rock. How fucking cool is he now? But still, I get it. They sure are compelling. They can be charming. It's a skill I'm certain came in handy when they were doing things that if you could be there for, if you could observe firsthand, you would scream like you've never screamed before. You'd damn near scream your soul away. Falling prey to a serial killer's charm is an issue I don't have with Dennis Rader. Sure, he was a family man who managed to live a normal life while moonlighting as one of the most feared human predators in history. But he was a klutz. He fucked up almost every time he did something. And in the end was only saved by his meticulous planning. The struggle to keep myself from falling prey to his charm is non-existent, because he has none. He'd like you to believe he does, but he's just a loser who's playing a part, who would never be able to get away with what he did back then, today, like many of them. And it's nice for once just to be able to tell of what a piece of shit did one day, and see clearly throughout that that's all he is and was. A self-serving and tremendously pathetic piece of shit. BTK, Dennis Rader, will be in and out of the news forever. But beyond all the mystique, the flashy nickname, the silly letters he wrote, the scary pictures he took, the odd clues he placed around Wichita that make for one hell of a true crime story, is a man who intended to have his way with a woman and her daughter one morning and ended up completely in over his head due to poor intel. The only reason we even know of Dennis Rader today is because the Otero family was nice enough not to beat him to death. He exists proudly behind bars at this very moment as the prolific serial killer known as BTK, because those like him were still a fairly unknown entity when he first started out. He may be notoriously known. Perhaps his face is even on the Mount Rushmore of American serial killers, to some even. But he is far from the most competent. And I'd like to think that the crime I'm about to speak of is not completely unnecessary to retell, that maybe we can learn from it. And if not, hopefully we can at least see past Dennis Rader's manufactured alter ego, his so-called Factor X, and take a hard look at what an empty man did to a family full of love on a cold January day, 45 years ago. A day he still lives to remember clearly, fondly, and a day the surviving family members still struggle to forget. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is episode 30, The Otero Family Murders. Dennis Rader was laid off. His position at the Cessna manufacturing plant had become dispensable due to the oil embargo crisis and subsequent nosedive in aircraft sales. It was late 1973, and Dennis was in his 30s, a couple years into marriage, depressed, restless, and with time on his hands. He turned inward and drew upon the dark fantasies that had always danced around the edge of his thoughts and came into play whenever he was sexual with himself. Which was a lot. The fantasies came forward eagerly, and soon they morphed into a raging beast, an insatiable monster. He would later refer to the seed that sprouted this monster as Factor X, something he eventually was able to control to a degree by what he thought of as cubing, his term for one that already exists, compartmentalization. But this isn't about Dennis Rader. This is about what he did to four members of the Otero family, soon after he embraced the darkness within himself. As Dennis began to turn, so did the year, and like his heart, January of 1974 was an icy one in Wichita, Kansas. He started dropping off and picking up his wife at the hospital where she worked, to ensure her safety, he'd tell her. But truly, he wanted an excuse to aimlessly cruise the streets of Wichita, and beyond, something that in time he would begin to think of as trolling, spotting women who tickled his fancy and allowing himself to fantasize as to what it would be like to possess these women. Fantasies about a barn. An old abandoned barn where he would lay track within and roll in a couple of trains. Attach the women, their hands to one, their feet to the other, and pull them apart. Ridiculous things. Dennis read too many comic books. Fortunately, this never came to fruition. Dennis, like I said, fucked up everything when he got into the house. He's lucky he even got out of there half the time, with his pants on. Rader took to stalking certain areas of which he'd spotted an interesting female, and began toying with the idea of what it would take to manifest such fantasies into reality. Dennis loved planning. He loved projects. He had many going at one time. If he didn't get one, he had another right down the street. The clouds of depression parted when he let the picture show of his darkest desires play out in his mind. And soon those clouds would be swept away entirely by a vicious wind that would elate, enthrall, and sustain Dennis Rader for the better part of his adult life. It all started when Dennis came across a small white house that appeared to have a new family living in it, the Otero House. It was a corner home, which bode well for escape routes. The mother and daughter of the family had caught his eye. He loved Hispanic women. He had been fascinated with them since his youth, when he'd obsessed over Annette Funicello, a member of the original Mickey Mouse Club, whom he'd written dark fantasy stories about back in grade school. Yes, this monster was a long time in the making, and when he finally came of age, the results would shock the world. Joe Otero was born in Puerto Rico, but landed in mainland America as a boy, and grew up in New York City's Spanish Harlem. He was a tough kid, though fun-loving and motivated. Boxing was a major passion, something he was quite good at, winning championships in his time. He met his wife Julie in the neighborhood. Julie was a striking young woman, popular and full of life and love. A prize. She'd come over from Puerto Rico as well, and the two dated for a couple of years before marrying. 9 months later, they had their first child, Charlie. Charlie would later describe his mother as an angel. Joe entered the Air Force as soon as he was eligible, and enjoyed a 20-year career during which he traveled a bunch, picking up exotic recipes everywhere he went, and becoming quite the cook as a result. Julie held things down at home with their growing family, a family that would grow to include 5 kids. She enjoyed judo, eventually becoming a brown belt, a significant ranking, and encouraged her children to go to classes as well. She was devoted to her family, didn't drink, was a devout Catholic, and just wanted the best for everyone. Joe retired from the military in his mid-30s and decided to lay down roots in Wichita, Kansas, the air capital of the world, with companies like Cessna, Beechcraft, and Stearman all choosing to build plants there. It was a hub of aircraft manufacturing, and Joe easily found work as a mechanic and flight instructor. The family took up residence at 803 North Edgemoor, a little white house on a corner lot. I have a little white house on a corner lot, as does a family that closely resembles the Oteros who live across the street from me. This is creepy, but I watched that family. See what Raider must have seen while trolling. The comings and goings. Raider chose a house on a corner lot because of how they're situated. A corner lot has more exit points and is a little more private and accessible. Sometimes I worry about my neighbors, about the holes I see in their routines. Then I realize my home is a mirror image of theirs. And drop the blinds. Pull up my pants. Small homes are just fine if you have love, and the Oteros had that in full stock. On the morning of January 15, 1974, after the three oldest kids had left for school, Julie Otero worked alongside her youngest kids, making sandwiches for school in the kitchen. Joe was still home, though he typically would have been gone for work by this time. It's unclear why he hadn't left yet. Maybe he'd taken time off to heal from a rib injury he'd suffered in a car accident. The crime scene would later offer that he had sat at the kitchen table, eating pears from a can. He maybe conversed with his kids as he did so. 11-year-old Josefina, or Josie, was described as a shy, sensitive, easygoing young girl who wrote poetry and loved art. Of all the kids, Josie was seen as the top student, which was a proud distinction within the Otero clan. Joe Sr. demanded his children achieve top grades, as well as participate in extracurricular activities. As a result, Josie held a yellow belt in judo. She was in the sixth grade and was turning into a beautiful young woman. She wore glasses and, in photos, comes off as everything I just described. She looks sweet, cute, shy, bright. Josie was very close to her older sister, Carmen. They were outnumbered by their three brothers and stuck together, though everyone was close in the Otero family. She had finished making her sandwich, as evidenced later, and perhaps laughed as the youngest, 9-year-old Joseph Jr., was asked by his father to take out the trash. Joey was a popular kid in his fourth grade class. He was a yellow belt as well, and excelling in judo. A quick kid, both in mind and in athletics. The school photos of Joe Jr. show a bright-eyed, smiling kid, clearly full of spirit and light. On Joseph's fifth birthday, he'd been given a German Shepherd that the family had named Lucky. Junior was all dressed for school that morning and working on his sandwich artistry when he was tasked to do the garbage chore. He called Lucky as he pulled the back door open and unwittingly allowed entrance to a monster. Raider had parked nearby, then hopped the Otero's back fence and crept to the back door. He noticed paw prints in the snow and began to doubt his entire plan immediately. He was wearing an Air Force parka packed with items such as cord, tape, and a gun in the pocket. This was a green BTK, in more ways than one. Early on, he made a point to wear green pants and a green sweater as a wink to one of his idols, the Boston Strangler, a.k.a. the Measuring Man, a.k.a. the Green Man, who wore a green uniform to fool women into believing he was an upstanding man on the job before raping them, apologizing profusely all the while. In future projects, Raider would be sure to always carry a hit kit, which made his items easier to keep track of. From inside the house, Raider hears the voice of a man. This is not how he envisioned this. Raider was 7 years younger than Joe Otero Sr. and had served time in the Air Force as well. The two had never met, and Raider had planned on that continuing to be the case following this event. He thought he'd had everything covered. He'd even called the house after retrieving their phone number from the library. Julie answered every time. He had watched this home and seen Joe leave almost every day before this time, approximately 7:45 a.m. He had never seen the dog. Maybe this wasn't the best day. He cuts the phone line with a knife and waits to see if he'll actually go through with it. Raider begins to waffle a bit, but something inside of him is overriding his impulse to bail out, egging him on like a heavy-handed coach. Suddenly, the back door opens. Raider doesn't hesitate. He draws his gun, a .22 Woodsman auto-target pistol, and herds Junior and his dog back into the house. Lucky barked like crazy as Raider tried to get his bearings. Immediately, he had lost control. Everyone was panicking at the sight of the armed intruder. Raider swings his pistol around, sweating, confused, not sure exactly what to do about all this. Joe Sr. offers to put the dog outside, and Raider begrudgingly agrees, not thrilled with giving up any power over the situation. He watches Joe carefully as he does so, not entirely worried that the man will flee, leaving his family with the armed intruder. Raider begins to explain that he's on the run from authorities and only wants some money in a vehicle. This plan of attack he had picked up from his reading material. Truman Capote's book In Cold Blood and the Clutter family murders immediately comes to his mind now, while faced with an entire family under his control. And without wholly realizing it, he had just begun his own true crime story, forever to be retold as well. He promises that nobody will be hurt if they all comply, but he has to tie them up to ensure he can safely get what he needs from them, without putting himself at risk of being attacked and disarmed. Raider thought of this as his Russ. He meant ruse, but the man who's about to become BTK wasn't a wordsmith. Some try to pin him as stupid for this, but Raider was far from stupid. I think he was more stubborn than stupid. And once he understood something to be a certain way, as long as it worked for him, it stuck. Raider orders the terrified family into the master bedroom and has them all lie on their stomachs on the bed with their hands behind their backs. The kids are crying, but not outright. They're trying to be brave, like their parents. But they're just kids. The parents are telling Raider to take whatever he wants. They won't move. No problem. Raider tells Joe Sr. to get on the floor. Once he does, Raider takes to thoroughly taping the biggest threat's wrists behind his back. Then moves on to Julie, the second largest threat. He wraps tape around her wrists and ankles and knees. That brown belt of hers now of no use. Raider then pulled some cotton twine out, the stuff used to pull Venetian blinds, and wrapped both of the now sobbing kids' hands and ankles. He used what was left to doubly tie up Joe Sr., after apparently helping Joe get more comfortable due to his accident by putting a blanket or a coat under him. Raider then ties Sr.'s legs to the bedpost. The family now secured, to Raider's satisfaction, he tears strips of pillowcasing and applies gags to each of the Oteros. He then pulls out white plastic grocery bags and puts one over the now thrashing Joe Sr.'s head and ties it around his neck with cord. Raider then hops onto the bed as it jerks from Joe Otero's death throes. Raider begins manually strangling Julie as her daughter looks on in horror beside her, and her son cries out from the bedside. When BTK believes that Julie is dead, he heads back over to Joe, who can be heard hyperventilating. He's rubbed a hole in the bag and bitten through it. BTK wraps a cloth around the man's face, reapplies a bag, and ties it again. Joe Sr. bites his own tongue nearly in half as he struggles to free himself. But he is doomed, as is his family. I'm going to step away real quick and say that this scene is only able to be described from Raider's journal, interviews, and testimony in court, and only backed up by what was the eventual crime scene. I did my best. Joe Sr. took post-mortem heat for allowing himself to be tied up. Guess fucking what? You would have done the same thing. A lot of heroes out there think they could look a gun in the eye and just start swinging, getting shot dead in an instant, and leaving the intruder to murder your family too because they witnessed it. Raider was without a mask. Well, actually, he had a balaclava on his head that he'd failed to pull down. The klutz. If I was Joe Otero, I would deduce that this guy really was on the fly. He was sweating. He was panicked. You know, he had this gun out, and he was only asking for the vehicle, for the car keys, and for some money. Joe thought that this was the truth, that he had just hopped into the house to rob a little, and he'd be gone quicker than he came if they complied. I only know not to ever let anyone tie me up because of what happened to Joe Otero. BTK was an anomaly of anomalies. I don't even think Dennis Raider knew he had it in him until he started letting it out. He was probably surprised by his own depravity. How the hell could Joe Otero read a man who wasn't yet written? It's infuriating to have to glean what really happened from the only witness account, especially when the only witness is the psychopath who caused the whole thing, and has a vested interest in making the story suit his interpretation. If I went based on his courtroom confession, you'd think Dennis was just a guy who found himself in an impossible position, and because the family had seen his face, he was forced to kill them. He shares what he did to the Oteros as if it were the only humane thing he could do. This is bothersome, for many reasons. I believe in the death penalty because of guys like Raider. I think he should be dead because he is enjoying his infamy Also, and this is a big one for me, I know he jerks off to the memory of this day on occasion. The true details of what happened still swirl in his mind whenever he wants to relive them. He believed that the Oteros would, and will, serve him in the afterlife. Joe will be his bodyguard. Julie will bathe him and attend to his every need. Joe Jr. will be his boy servant and male sex toy. He wrote this shit. Josephina, who has the audacity to call Josie, would be his star maiden to teach sex to and practice BDSM upon. Dennis Rader, who is currently still alive in prison and has been mentally stimulated throughout the years since his arrest in 2005 by assisting authors in writing books and playing a fantasy stock exchange with the help of newspapers, and doing quite well, he might add. Dennis Rader gets to live and buzz off of his infamy, while the surviving Oteros try to live on without thinking about this shit every day. And the rest of us are left to take in what he did next. Could this be your summer of discovery? Yeah, with Rosetta Stone it could be. Whether you're traveling abroad, planning a staycation, or just shaking up your routine, what better time to dive into a new language? With Rosetta Stone, you could turn downtime into meaningful progress. Rosetta Stone is a trusted leader in language learning for over 30 years. Their immersive, intuitive method helps you naturally absorb and retain your new language on desktop or mobile, whenever and wherever it fits your summer schedule. I've been using it to try to learn Japanese, as I mentioned already multiple times. I mean, Rosetta Stone and I are good friends at this point, and I'm surprised how quickly you can pick things up in bite-sized lessons. And what I mean by that is, like, if you're planning on going somewhere or interacting with someone who has another language underneath their belt or a country that is required to speak that language wherever you are in certain situations, you can pick up bite-sized things to get you by. And I really like that about it. And it makes you feel like you are learning when you haven't developed the entire scope of it. At least you have a foot in the door with these bite-sized lessons and learning with their true accent feature. Rosetta Stone is the trusted language expert. It has 30 years of experience teaching people. I mean, there's millions of users and 25 languages to choose from, including Spanish, French, German, Japanese, and more. Rosetta Stone is a go-to tool for real language growth, and you can learn faster, retain longer. The big thing with Rosetta Stone for me is that you get this lifetime membership with them when you sign on, and you just never know when it's going to come in handy. Whatever trip comes up in the future, you can prepare yourself with this in your back pocket. So don't wait. Unlock your language learning potential right now. Dark Topic listeners can grab Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for life. Visit rosettastone.com/today to get started and claim your 50% off today. Go to rosettastone.com/today and start learning today. This episode is brought to you by IQ Bar, our exclusive snack and hydration sponsor here at Dark Topic. And we're so excited to announce they've teamed up with Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry, on two special edition products, a salted caramel chip protein bar and a yuzu mango hydration mix drink. And I've been eating a whole hell of a lot of salted caramel chip protein bars. I don't get sick of them. That's one thing I'll say about those. It's a great treat. And decent for you, as well as the yuzu mango hydration mix drink. I mean, I'll have one before bed. I'll have one when I wake up in the morning. Something about it. I mean, really great flavor, and makes me feel like I came back to life after I chug one of those bad boys. IQ Bar's plant protein bars, they're mixed with clean, delicious ingredients that keep you physically and mentally fit. The salted caramel chip IQ bar that I've just mentioned there, it has 12 grams of protein and only 1 gram of sugar, and it has brain-boosting nutrients in it like lion's mane, adaptogen. The yuzu mango IQ mix is a refreshing zero-sugar hydration mix that marries bold flavor and essential electrolytes for your body and lion's mane plus magnesium for your brain. Just mix with water for Michelin star taste and next-level hydration. 10% of sales, I should mention, go to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, which supports the next generation of aspiring U.S. chefs. With over 20,000 five-star reviews and counting, more people than ever are fueling their busy lifestyles with IQ bars, brain... Clearly, I didn't drink my yuzu drink this morning. Brain and body-boosting bars, hydration mixes, and mushroom coffees. This is the snack that you should start stocking in your cupboards when you go to reach for that
you know, ice cream at night, the chocolate bar during the day, I'd suggest reach for an IQ bar. They sent me the salted caramel chip IQ bar, the yuzu mango mix. And I mean, again, I've been going back and forth on those, and I just can't believe that something so delicious could be so good for me. And right now, IQ Bar is offering our special podcast listeners 20% of all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. To get your 20% off, text DARK to 64,000. Text DARK to the number 64,000. That's DARK to 64,000. Message and data rates may apply. See terms for details.
Dennis Rader will later claim that after he finishes off the parents by suffocating them in front of their hog-tied children, that he unsuccessfully strangles 11-year-old Josefina next. But I doubt it. He's saving her for last. Regardless, he apparently strangles Josefina to what he thinks is death, then puts a bag over a surely hysterical 9-year-old Joseph Jr.'s head. Julie, the mother, wills herself back to life at this point. She's only been knocked unconscious. Rader will later lament of how difficult it was to strangle someone with his bare hands. Nothing like how the movies made it out. Julie demands Rader take the bag off her son's head. Apparently he does, and Joe Jr. lays gasping on the floor. Rader sets the type of knot that made him a reputable Boy Scout troop leader. A clove hitch. Easy to tie and untie if you know what to do. He loops it over Miss Otero's head, and takes a posture above her that will give him maximum leverage. Mother Julie apparently says about the only thing I truly believe any of the victims said word for word. Quote, "May God have mercy on your soul." Rader then strangles the hog-tied defenseless woman to death in front of her still alive children. He's shocked when the blood that has been filling her eyes suddenly bursts from her mouth and nose. Julie Otero has clearly died. Before moving on to the kids, Dennis covers her face with a pillow. In a fleeting moment of shame, Rader glances over at Junior. He notices that the boy is playing possum. His eyes are closed, but his face betrays the effort to keep them so. Josefina may be playing the same game, but no matter. Both are hogtied, and she'll be here when he gets back. She was the main reason for his visit, after all. This, his first project, his first PJ, and it's titled PJ Little Mex. She's not Mexican, of course, but Dennis likes the ring of it. Rader gets off the bed and heads out of the room. He returns soon after with more shopping bags and a couple of shirts. He wraps one of the tees around the helpless little boy's face. Junior, Dennis will later call him in court, like he was one of his scout kids. Rader then straps on a bag over the boy's face, then wraps another t-shirt over top of this. Joe Jr. begins freaking out. Rader carries the helpless boy into his room and lays him on his bed. As the boy struggles and tumbles to the ground, his legs and arms and face bound, Rader grabs a chair and slams his ass down in it, breaking one of the supports underneath. He intently observes the 9-year-old's final moments, fascinated by how long it takes. When Joseph Jr. finally dies, Dennis Rader, future family man, church president, scout leader, takes a mental picture and then heads back into the master bedroom. Josefina is awake and likely in shock. This is what he wanted. This 11-year-old girl all to himself. He leaves her for now and tromps down to the basement, where he finds a sturdy pipe, which he throws a rope over and fashions a noose. He's mock-hung himself many times in his own parents' cellar, and this will not be much different, preparation-wise at least. He heads back upstairs and gets the girl. As he guides her away from her dead parents and past her dead brother, the downstairs to the basement of which BTK equates to a dungeon. This 31-year-old man asks the bound 11-year-old girl if she has a camera. She does not. Oh well, he thinks. His mind will have to serve. He promises the worn-out little girl that she'll be with her family soon, in heaven, and a shocked expression explodes from her lethargic face. This pleases Rader, who then pushes her head into the noose and slowly strangles the little girl. He pulls down her pants and underwear as she fights off her inevitable death and masturbates over her leg as she succumbs to strangulation, a strangulation that he controls and prolongs, letting her little feet hit the floor at times so she can recover before hoisting her again as he furiously tugs at himself. Rader doesn't outright rape any of his victims, Some say this is because he was a married man, a Lutheran, that he thought that would be cheating, that it wouldn't be right, but I think that's ridiculous. It's just because this was just about power, it wasn't about sex. Sure, he masturbated, but he wasn't getting off in the physical contact with them, he was getting off on their pain and his power over them. This guy's alive right now, maybe even reliving this shit in pure detail, nightly. Before leaving, BTK performed the right-hand rule and swept the house for evidence, taking Joe Sr.'s watch as a memento. He grabs a radio from Joey Jr.'s room too, something he would later claim he didn't remember the reason for. Most likely it is because the culprits in the infamous Clutter family murder stole a radio as well. Mainly, he took the lives of Joe, Julie, Josie, and Joey. They were just a family making sandwiches. They knew judo. Dad was a boxer. German Shepherd in the house, and still, what the fuck? Stay paranoid. The three older kids returned home from school and noticed that the garage was open, the car missing. Their mom had gone to pick up Joey and Josie from school, no doubt. They could hear Lucky barking in the backyard, which was a little odd. Dad wouldn't put up with much of that. They entered to an unusually warm house. BTK had cranked the heat before leaving, thinking that maybe that might mess with the time of death. He did his best to cover his tracks, though after he had left the house, driving the Otero family vehicle to a nearby parking lot, he had returned in his own vehicle to retrieve a knife he had left by the phone line after cutting it. Like I said, Dennis Rader was a klutz that considered himself a meticulous evil genius, a phantom who rarely left any clue behind. Of course, he'd left his semen in the basement, but whatever. I did not mention the other Otero kids' names in the beginning. They were and are Charlie, Danny, and Carmen. At first, they thought their mom and dad were playing a trick on them. After a minute of observing their stiff, unmoving, bound parents, Charlie, the eldest, grabbed a knife and cut their father free from his bindings. It was clear that this wasn't a prank now, as his arms spread apart as if thawing. Carmen took to snipping at her mother's mouth gag with fingernail clippers. The group was hysterical as they realized their parents were gone. Picking up the phone to call for help was of no use. The phone, too, was dead. They ran to a neighbor who came over alone and beelined to the Otero's bedroom. There he saw what looked at first glance to be a murder-suicide, as Joe had a knife beside him, the knife the kids had dropped after cutting the bindings from their father's hands. As responders swarm in, the kids first plead with medics to save their mom and dad, but there's nothing that can be done. The eldest boy, Charlie, directs Danny and Carmen to go intercept Joey and Josie from school. He doesn't want them to stumble upon the chaos. The police soon share the somber news that his younger siblings are inside and dead as well. One officer asked Charlie if his father would have any reason to hurt his family. What a fucking mess.
Dark Topic is an 1159 Media production. To support on Patreon, visit patreon.com/darktopicpod. For merch, or just to reach out, visit darktopicpodcast.com.